Well, hello. Welcome to episode 82 of the Payers and Players podcast. Before we get started, also, if you would, go follow us on Twitter at Payers Players. We've got some subscribers that are rolling in. We are trying to constantly put content out there for our subscribers that's quality. So if you would, follow us on Twitter at Payers Players. We've got back Trent Tucker for episode number 2 with him. We got such a huge response from the crowd or from our listeners that we wanted to bring him back. So much to talk about. And what we have on the agenda is so extensive, I imagine we'll have to have him for an episode 3. So Trent, welcome to back to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Great. Yeah, absolutely, Robert. You know, I got so many messages that, you know, typically on a podcast, I might get one or two, hey, good jobs, but I got messages from all over, you know, our listenership saying how impactful that was. We have, you know, people saying how they're able to use some of the stuff that Trent shared as coaches in their lessons. So a really impactful episode and one of the best I think we ever did. So go in, you know, say before listening to this one, if you haven't listened to the first episode with Trent, go ahead and listen to that first and then ease into this one. So
Scott, is that episode 79?
Yes, sir.
Also, the funny thing is I even had a listener send me a picture. So, Trent, who was the player that you, when you first got in, you started, was his name Crunch?
Yeah, David Crunch Cloverdance from Oklahoma City.
What was funny was, you know, you mentioned that when you got started, he was like the top player. And so I had a listener send me a picture of her and Crunch both, and I don't know what tournament they were at. But I want to call out Mariana Taylor. Mariana was a high-level player, played at, I think, both Georgia and North Carolina. May have won a national championship at both places. So she sent us that picture. I may ask her for permission for us to tweet it out. But, man, you had a lot of folks that were excited about that episode. So, Scott, why don't you take it away?
Sure. Yeah, at the end of the first episode we did with Trent, you know, you talked a little bit about how players have changed over the course of your coaching career the last 20 years. Maybe we could pick it up there and talk about how you have changed as a coach over those last 20 years.
Sure. I mean, I think the coaching journey for me, really, it started when I was, you know, in my 20s and I had moved back from Europe playing some professional tournaments. And, you know, you think of yourself at the time more as kind of this hybrid coach player. And you know, when you're young and you're just kind of coming off tournaments, and you have a very different perspective maybe than where I was, say, 20, 25 years later. And really the journey, I think, is a healthy evolution, but it's important, I think, at least for me, to look back and realize that I was maybe focused too much, you know, in the mindset of me being a player. And, you know, the journey is complicated because I think to see what it's like or to remember what it's like to be a 9, 10, or 12-year-old boy or girl playing, competing, learning new things. You know, when you're 23 or 24, you just oftentimes forget that because you're so coming right off the intense, you know, battles and playing, you know, professional tournaments or whatever it may be. So, you know, my journey was trying to figure out. It was a lot of experimentation in the early years of various you know, techniques or tricks or little kind of, you know, ways to engage kids that had different learning capabilities and experiment with ways to get kids to, you know, move the racket a certain way or, you know, to create spin or to learn a slice or whatever the things. But, you know, when you get older and as you go through the journey a little bit, you know, you've kind of developed, you know, a whole kind of a list of best practices, if you'll say. So, you know, here's the 7 or 8 ways that I've been able to over the years to get a kid to learn how to slice a backhand. Or here's, you know, 4 or 5 different, you know, and you just, you know, you really, in the beginning of the process of the coaching journey, you also maybe don't have the empathy, you know, of you do when you're older of what it's like, you know, to be the parent or the kid in that early part of the process. And so, you know, my journey was a lot of kind of awakenings over the years. You know, those first 5 years was a lot of, you know, I want to get kids to win, you know, I want them to play, you know, a certain way, and you do all these things, right? But as you get a little more seasoned and as I, you know, made more mistakes and I recognize things and start to figure out patterns, I tried to create kind of a, you know, a list of genres where I would kind of classify kids as learners into these genres a little bit, and it would help me kind of shorten the cycle of teaching, right, in a particular topic. And so I would always, you know, kind of as I go along, because the first 5 to 6 years of coaching, you just don't know even how much you don't know, right? And you know, and as I got a little farther along, I started to be able to say, okay, this player has these tendencies. Oh, I remember 5 or 6 years ago, I had this other kid who had the same thing. Let me try what worked with that kid. And then you just build this repertoire of kind of methods and, you know, maneuvers of how to get people to learn faster, right? So my journey was really just a lot about kind of designing my own kind of system, right? My own, if you think back to the 80s, like when I was a kid, we had a card catalog at the library. We didn't have the internet, you know? So I kind of made my own card catalog system of ways to teach people how to do things. And that went through, that really came from a lot of failures, a lot of experimenting, a lot of bouncing ideas off of coaches, looking stuff up, watching tons of people, taking little, you know, video clips with a portable camera that we had, you know, 20 years ago, whatever. You know, it's a funny thing, because now that I look back now after doing it for 25 years, I can very quickly identify certain flaws or things that are common that I see in kids, you know, or they, you know, certain traits that you just recognize after teaching tens of thousands of lessons, right? And so, you know, I would say that the best way for me to define as all my coaching journey is that I got more efficient, right? And I developed my own systems, and then I tried to share those with coaches, share those, you know, with parents or whoever was the kind of the main person involved in the kids that we're working with in our entire program. You know, so for me, the coaching journey was just a lot of failing, a lot of experimenting, a lot of learning, but ultimately trying to get extremely efficient at identifying my best practices, you know, and I learned from so many people. I mean, there was nobody I was afraid to ask a question from, you know. So yeah, that's probably a pretty good way of summarizing that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting, when I was coaching, and I coached football and golf in a public school environment. And I had, as a teacher, I had a parent one day show up at my classroom. I may have told this story on the podcast before. I don't know if I have. But when I turned the corner to walk to my classroom, I had a parent with her child standing there, because I would do morning tutoring, right? And it was free and kids would show up. She showed up that morning, and here's what she said to me. And it kind of flew over me at first. She said, "I don't think anybody should be able to teach until they've had children." And then she said, and then she left, right? And at that time, I was probably 21, 22. And I didn't know what exactly she was saying, but I thought to myself, well, there wouldn't be very many teachers if that were true. But what she was saying was the rigor and the quantity of work I was giving her child was at such a level, it was making their life miserable at night, right? Mm. And it took me having a child to know what she meant by that. And so I wonder for you, now that you've got children, how has the children that you have affected how you would approach coaching at this point?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, there's no question that I think the number one thing is that you develop empathy. You develop just a sense of understanding of what it's like to have someone's most precious thing in their life in your hands for X number of hours per day. In addition to that, the incredible responsibility that you bear as a coach to impact that child in a positive way for their whole life, right? The way they look at things. There are so many kids that look at the coach and listen to what they say at certain stages in their life far more than they'll listen to their parents. And so, you know, me as a parent, I started to recognize that and realize how powerful, you know, being a coach really can be in a good or bad way. And I started to deeply respect, you know, what it's like to be, you know, a parent. And so then the pressure of being a coach now becomes so much different than when I was in my 20s and did not have children. You just sort of say, oh, tough it out, or oh, you'll figure it out, or, you know, do 1,000 pushups, you know, whatever it is, right? You don't really understand the gravity of the words you're saying oftentimes You know, and maybe some people do, but I certainly didn't understand fully at that time. Having my own children gave me a way deeper understanding and perspective into what it's like, and just how precious the opportunity is, and how every word you say can be so impactful long term. And also, you know, just making sure you respect the dollars that people are spending, make sure you respect the driving time, make sure you're on time and prepared. You know, just those little things go a really long way, because I'm a parent now, and I know sometimes I get stuck in traffic 45 minutes to drive my daughter to a 30-minute tutor, right? Or a 30 yeah. or 45-minute, you know, piano lesson. And I'll drive 45 minutes each way. And I just, it just kills me if I, you know, go see the coach and he's on his phone for 5 minutes of that 30 or 45 minute lesson, right? So, you know, I just think you start to mature after having your own children in general, but then you also have the ability to look through the lens and respect what the other parents might be dealing with and going through. So it just makes you much more conscious of the things you do, the words you say, the actions you take. I think that's kind of the most important part for me.
You know, Trent, when you think about the coaching business in tennis, when I coached football, I would go to clinics, I would read books. I'm watching, Scott sends me last night a text about, Scott, what's the show? Episode one came out last night, Swamp Kings or something.
Right, on Netflix, yeah.
Yeah, and it's basically chronicling the run that Urban Meyer had at the University of Florida. And I remember hearing him at coaching clinics, going to coaching clinics, hearing him speak, hearing Dan Mullen speak. And really, as a coach, I was very much a student of the game. I wanted to be as good a coach as I could possibly be. I don't necessarily see that in the tennis coaching world, where it's not just about making money as a coach or teaching lessons, but that student of the game wanting to learn, the fraternity. You know, you were talking beforehand about coaches that you interact with, that they interact with you, and it's a small fraternity. Why do you think tennis doesn't approach the coaching the same way that other sports do?
Well, part of it is that there's not a really long-standing tradition of mentorship at a national level, you know, where, you know, really famous coaches are mentoring, and there's not this sort of respect for that hierarchy. Everybody kind of comes in with a big ego because maybe they were a great player or whatever. So I think that contributes to it. You know, we were very fortunate when we were partnered with the USTA as a regional training center. You know, that relationship, we still are, but that relationship, they would send, you know, like a well-known seasoned coach like an Andy Brandy, and he would come in and work with my staff, work with myself, teach some clinics, teach lessons, and we would videotape everything. Then we would review and, you know, kind of learn from him. And then we would send all our coaches to the USTA to be high performance certified. Then we would maybe bring in a guy, maybe a European coach who maybe came from an academy in Europe, and have him speak and teach them in some of their drills. I guess the whole thing is you have to be humble enough, one, to start with, and then there has to be some culture in our sport of mentorship, and there's a lot of protection, and I want to keep that to myself, and I can make money if I keep that, not really proprietary, but sort of under wraps, if you'll say. And so, unfortunately, you know, there hasn't been this longstanding culture of helping the whole industry grow by sharing knowledge. You know, a handful of us have done that, but I feel like it could be way more powerful on a national level if everybody. But people get so busy, they don't make time. They don't see the value maybe in saying, okay, I'm going to cancel lessons for 4 days. I'm going to go to, you know, Indianapolis and see Brian Smith, or I'm going to go, you know, to another location, or to JTCC and see Vesapanka, whatever it may be, and go spend some time. I remember I went one time to Los Angeles to the USTA West Coast National Training Center, and I watched this coach, Leo Azevedo. He was coaching the best three or four girls in the US under 18. And I sat on his court from dusk till dawn every day taking handwritten notes. And I mean, I took pages of notes, right? And some video clips and different things. And I went home and I kind of extracted all the best things that I could. And then I just made sure the whole staff and I had a meeting to try to basically disseminate that information from not just me, but to 16 more coaches, right? And then hopefully as they leave my program over time or promote it or whatever happens, they'll share stuff like that. So, you know, but that's just one small effort. But I mean, imagine if we had that on a national scale, you'd see tennis coaching, I think, improve dramatically across the country, because a lot of people simply are just winging it. So.
Yeah, totally winging it. I see exactly what you're saying. They aren't students of the game. They aren't fired up about it, excited about it. It's the life that they live. And so, like you said, they'll show up to a lesson, and they won't decide until 5 minutes before, literally looking at their watch going, okay, I got to give this lesson in 5 minutes. What am I even going to teach this kid?
Right? Yeah, well, that's part of the coaching journey that we talked about earlier, is you have to have the maturity to get organized. And basically, like we talked about, you know, before, come in with a plan, and you have to have the ability to, you know, adapt that plan midway based on the, you know, how the player is responding or feeling. But organization, both from the player and the coach, is a kind of a chronic problem in tennis, in junior tennis in the country. There's a lot, and I was talking to a buddy of mine about this, the comparison in golf lessons and tennis lessons. You know, in a tennis lesson, a lot of people sign up because they want to just get a workout, or they want to drill a certain pattern. I just want to hit cross court forehands, or I want to, you know, just hit a bunch of overheads and some volleys, whatever it may be, right? But there's not this sort of, you know, very detailed, organized approach. I would imagine that, you know, you talk to a Brad Gilbert, who's a famous professional coach. You see he's working with Coco Gauff and what her results just were at the most recent Cincinnati tournament. But, you know, you talk to one of these famous coaches, I guarantee you that they are extremely detailed in the day-to-day approach, the every single session on court, you know, is incredibly detailed. So yeah, I think that's a problem we have in the whole, you know, in the whole coaching industry in tennis.
Well, it's about intentionality. When I show up today, am I intentional with what I'm doing with the player? And like you said, as a parent, you're driving 30 minutes to the lesson, 45 minutes to the lesson, whatever it is, and then back. The only thing you want from the coach is that when you drop your child off, that they're intentional, that they have a purpose for the lesson, that they that they attack the lesson with the intentionality and the uniqueness, I guess you will, for that individual child, instead of every lesson looking exactly the same. And the only thing that changes is the player that's standing on the court, and the coach is just feeding balls, and it's the exact same drills over and over again.
Yeah, it's that's tragic when that happens. You know, you have to be able to quantify development, right? So you need to have documented, you know, here's where we are, maybe take a video, work on it for 90 days. Here's where we are again, take another video, and then be willing to share that with the player, all the stakeholders, the parent, everyone involved, right? And even with I'd like to do that with my staff, almost in a competitive, fun sort of way. Hey, look where I took so-and-so over the last 90 days on their forehand. Look where I took so-and-so on their backhand slide. And then get other coaches to almost get competitive with you and say, hey, I think I can get someone to learn that in 60 days, you know, whatever it may be. But the ability to quantify things and measure them, you know, based on the time is important, because if you think about a junior player, you don't have that much time. I mean, you know, it's like you really need to be more in the competitive phase of the cycle when you're more 17, 18. So it's really kind of those early years, kind of 9 to about 16, that becomes super important. Well, that's just not that much time. And when you break it all down. So, you know, I think coaches need to be, one, very accountable to them, hold themselves accountable, document their process, be willing to compete with themselves and others in a fun way on how that process is going, just to encourage, you know, themselves to work harder, to get more creative. Or, you know, it's funny when you see a kid at a clinic that is really engaged in a process like I'm describing right now, you'll see a coach come up to them way more often and whisper in their ear, how's it going? How's that slice? Or, hey, let me see you try this, or whatever it may be, right? But when you see a kid that's involved in a coaching scenario where the coach is just sort of feeding them balls, there's no sort of, excitement or you know, anticipation of, hey, how's that going? Or where are we at today? Or how's that progress? You know, it's sort of just, oh yeah, how you hitting them today? And it's a very different vibe for both the player and the coach when you're not tracking towards something. And so having these short-term goals and monitoring them and then the pressure of hitting them, that to me, that's the only thing that makes, you know, coaching effective. Well, I mean, not the only, but it's a huge driver of what makes it effective. Otherwise, you're just sort of hoping that if you just throw enough stuff at the wall, the kid gets better, and that can happen. But man, you're missing out on explosive growth in my mind.
Yeah. And one of the things you talk about was, you know, quantifying, you know, progress. And I think one of the dangerous things is like UTR. And so, you know, a lot of people will just say, well, if my UTR is going up, then I must be getting better. But you know, maybe you're just relying on a bad technique that's going to help you over a short period, but not the long term. How do you sort of, you know, work with that? Because like you say, you know, if you're trying to change a kid's stroke and you're going to say, I can show you from, you know, day one to day 90, the improvement in the serve. But during that time period, maybe it went down, you know, they couldn't get a serve in because they were trying to do something new and the UTR is affected. And so how do you deal with you know, that kind of metric?
It's unfortunate because UTR means well, but it has a lot of flaws. And, you know, you might not even play a tournament for 6 months and your UTR goes up, right? You know, it just because of the nature of the algorithm, you might have beaten someone 9 months before that went on a hot streak and it pulls you up because they go way up, right? I mean, so it's unfortunate how people get bogged down or mentally lost in that metric. What really matters is the relationship between the coach and the player and where they feel like they're tracking. And if you stick to that and trust in that relationship and that process, the UTR will solve itself over time, right? Because ultimately, you know, wins are going to happen at a much more consistent level. I have literally seen kids not play tournaments for a year and celebrate their UTR going up. And I think to myself, well, you've really hurt your development. I'd rather you have played, you know, 50 matches and learned a whole bunch of things. And even if the UTR was the same or went down a little bit, you're going to gain a lot more in the long run, right? So that's unfortunate that happens a lot in our world. But you know, from a player perspective, you have to decide when it's time to value the UTR and when it's time to not value it and to value what's happening on the court in the trenches with a coach, right? And so too often children are constantly valuing that as the single metric, and then they use it almost as a badge of honor, you know, amongst their peers. Hey man, my UTR went from a 6.2 to a 6.6, you know, whatever, right? And they talk about it in a way that in my mind is not constructive. Instead of saying to their buddy, man, you should see this video of my backhand slice. This thing is knifing cross court now. That should be the thing to brag about. Or, hey, you should see me hitting this, you know, on the rise backhand down the line. I'm taking it so much earlier than I was 3 months ago. You know, so it's critical that the entire culture of the program, the coaches and the parents, everyone is celebrating the right things at the right time in the process. Now, maybe when you're 18, 17, and you're deep in the recruiting process of college, you know, the UTR becomes pretty important. You need to have some results. You need to be doing well at that point. But coaches can see very quickly if you're someone that pulls out of back draws all the time. They can see quickly if you dodge tournaments and only play weak tournaments and, you know, areas that are typically known not to be strong. You know, coaches aren't stupid. I mean, they're going to look at your record and know. So you can game the system a little bit, but at the end of the day, if you can't produce a winning result on a consistent basis, you know, it doesn't matter.
And if you were, say, in control of junior tennis, how would you, you know, use UTR? Would you say that, you know, under 16, it does not exist and don't look at it and it's just going to be zeros? And then, you know, let's say once you're a developed player, 16, 17 in the recruiting process, then it becomes live. Is there something like that that would, you know, would help in terms of, you know, getting away from the focus? Because, you know, like you say, you know, every kid, every parent knows their UTR and their competitors. And it's just, it does hinder the development process for sure.
Yeah, I don't think you can stop it no matter right. what. It's impossible to, you know, get rid of competition for young kids. And I think it's important to have competition. I just think what's gone wrong is that people, you know, identify themselves by a number, right? And not by a skill set. And so I think it has to be the combination. You have to, you know, have the skill set. I would rather a kid you know, identify themselves as a series of results and, you know, good wins that I've had or close losses with great players or whatever it may be, and then have them also, you know, celebrate, you know, how they're doing with their, you know, in the developmental process. But unfortunately, our culture is so narrow-minded that it's just, it's like, what is this number? Where are you at? And people get bogged down in that. To answer your question specifically, I think it's hard to eliminate because someone else will create something, and kids love to compete and they, you know, they want to play for the most part. Right. But I think it's a national cultural issue that we have fallen prey to this sort of, you know, what's your number or where's your kid at or what are you at, as opposed to saying, hey, how's your kid developing? How are they enjoying their process? How is their love of the game, right? And if we could change the conversation as the adults in the room and the coaches, the parents, all these people, you know, I think we could have a big impact on shifting the narrative from being, hey, what's your UTR number, as opposed to some of the other things I just mentioned. So, you know, I think it's got to be a shift culturally. And, you know, our program, hopefully, you know, it just, like, for example, you'll go upstairs and you'll hear kids ragging on other kids about their UTR, making jokes, whatever. It's part of the teenage culture, right? But if there's a director or a leader of a program that comes in and says, guys, hey, I understand that, you know, you guys like to make a big deal out of that or whatever it may be, but remember, you know, you've got a long way before you need to focus on that. And just having those reminders from people in a kind of a power position, like a program leader or a head coach or whatever it may be, can go a really long way in centering the mindset of these teenagers. You know, so that's how, you know, I think I would play it a little bit, because I don't think you can avoid, you know, these tournaments. I mean, whether it's USTA hosting 12 in internationals, you know, which is, you know, people playing for a gold ball when they're 11, 12 years old. That's a big, you know, amount of pressure and a big deal. Someone's going to fill the void of high level competition for a young kid. So I don't know if I'd get rid of it per se, but I'd try to shift the narrative.
So then if you're shifting the narrative, and I agree with you, I talk to my own child a lot about quit worrying about your UTR. If you get better, the UTR will naturally rise because you'll get wins that you didn't used to get that as you improve, right? So the UTR takes care of itself as your development improves. But how do you then think about academies who might use UTR to determine groupings or use UTR to determine which level of player they get to go to this side or play with that group or in this with this coach based on the UTR? Yeah. Do you like them using that as a measure?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question and a good one. You know, and we've experimented with so many different ways of doing things. You know, at some point you have to be able to, based on court limitations, you have to be able to create a cutoff in level, right, for a program. So whether you use a USTA ranking, whether you use a UTR ranking, UTR was, you know, very a pretty good metric for a long time, and I think it still is a good metric. You know, so it gives coaches or, you know, some level of ability to define, like you talked about, a class level or a cutoff point or whatever, because otherwise it's just ambiguous and people are going to say you're playing favorites, right? Oh, you just, because you coach so-and-so, you put them in this group, right? So you kind of in a no-win situation there when you're dealing with groupings and things. But it really, it's unfortunate because, like you mentioned, you said it, if you're doing the right things, over time, it will take care of itself, right? And I've always told people, you know, there's always a best kid in every program or a best one or two, right? And there's always a senior and there's always a freshman. You know, there's always that kind of dynamic. And I think it's important for kids to learn how to dominate a group. And then it's up to the coaches in that scenario, if they're dominating that group, to make sure that they are now blending that player in with another group of kids that give them multiple play up opportunities, right? So it's a delicate balance. And I think it's one that a good director or a good set of coaches should be able to navigate and manage well. And if the parents trust that program, it should work itself out. Because if a kid is dominating, you know, it's really actually a good thing for them to learn to dominate, because then it gives them the freedom to experiment with, let's say, serve and volley or, you know, various techniques, you know, that they're working on taking the ball super early or building weapons, ending points in two or three shots, et cetera, right? But then it also, you need to give them plenty of opportunities to play a bit over their head so they learn how to scrap and scramble and defend and how to, you know, deal with, you know, maybe a different speed or whatever it may be, right? So, you know, it's a conundrum for all programs and all coaches. And I think it's one that can be solved if people are trusting of the program and its leaders. And if those leaders do the right thing, you know, meaning they, you know, they try to create a cutoff, but then they recognize that that's going to always leave somebody in that top position and making sure that person's needs are being met for their development too.
Yeah. And then one of the other questions I wonder is if you're so one of the benefits of being in an academy is you get match play just about every day, right? So the experimentation, for example, of I'm going to serve and volley today, and yep. It's not going to count to my UTR because it's just match play, right? But what right. Do you do if you're a parent who has a child in a city where match play is hard to come by? And so for some of them, the tournaments are the match play. But yeah. Now they're worried to do things like serve and volley because if they lose, it affects their UTR.
Now you got to just play and take the losses, and you got to experiment. It doesn't matter. I mean, in the end, it doesn't really, unless you're the number one 14-year-old by far in the U.S., it doesn't really matter, let's say, because, you know, if you're number 100 in the country, 200 in the country, 500 in the country, it doesn't matter really. It just doesn't. And so you need to use that time to develop skills. I mean, guys, I'll just give you a little personal history. I started at almost age 12. I made nationals in the 14s and won one match out of four tournaments. Okay. So I'm like 150 in the rankings in the nationals, right? And then I go into 16s, don't even make Kalamazoo. I don't even make nationals. I'm first guy out. I take those 2 years, I play a bunch of tournaments when I'm 15 and 16, and I'm working on stuff, developing all kinds of things. I go into 18s and I do very well, and I'm top 50 in the country. I get a scholarship to school, you know, to college. All these things start happening. Point is that, you know, had I worried about things and, you know, not experimented in those 2 years at 15 and 16, I never would have had the tools, you know, to play in the 18s with the skills that I had, right? I would have been limited. And so it's critical that you're willing to sacrifice some events or designate certain events. So let's say I'm going to play 25 tournaments a year, or let's say I'm going to be 20 tournaments, round them, 20 tournaments a year, and I'm going to designate five of them as tournaments I'm going to work on X, Y, and Z. Five of them I'm going to try to peak for my maximum playability, and then, you know, maybe 10 of them I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to play normal based on how it is, right? How the schedule works out. I'm going to train right up to it. I'm going to be lifting weights or running right up to, you know, whatever it is. But you have to be smart about allowing yourself the freedom to develop. But I mean, you listen to Kobe Bryant podcast or something, right? And he talks about how he puts in all this extra time and how all these guys thought they were better than him. And then he's just experimenting in pickup games and in leagues, and he's doing all the working on all these new moves. And then at some point he's just, you know, he's way ahead of everybody because he was willing, you know, to work on things for an extended period of time. And then he becomes the master of those things. It's the same idea. It's just tennis players are so protective of wins and losses because they're very personal. It's a one-on-one sport, but you got to get over it.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. You know, too often we treat, you know, the local L5 as, hey, I'm building up to this, you know, tournament that's coming up. So I'm not going to, you know, do my conditioning because I don't want to be sore or tired for it. And, you know, it's just another match. You know, I think, you know, Matias, he talked about it, you know, one time when, he was playing for Baylor and they had a big match against Texas, but you know, the coach was like, this is just a regular season match. It's not the national championship. We're going to do a normal, you know, routine before the match. And that way the players played a lot looser and they didn't, you know, analyze themselves, or they didn't get over anxious, and they just treated like another match, and they won pretty easily against a really good team. But it is that thing when you start to treat everything like it's a big deal, then you don't put in the work you need to do in the gym and the conditioning and everything else, and that impacts the long-term development.
Yeah, that's an important mindset, I think, for coaches to get kids to understand. You have to train through some events. Some events, mm-hmm. you're going to be running sprints maybe right after your second round match, or you might be trained, because if you have an organized developmental plan, and this tournament that you've squeezed in here, maybe you know, is not a peak tournament on the schedule, well, then you're training through that tournament. You're lifting weights, right, or you're running or whatever it may be. And you just have to trust in that process.
So I want to maybe switch gears a little bit and go back to, you know, sort of the first podcast we did where you talked, you know, about developing and the culture at Tucker Tennis Academy. And, you know, how do you sort of build that winning culture from scratch? And then, you know, how does you have that identity, you know, say when people see kids from Tucker Tennis Academy, they know what kind of player there is. Talk a little bit about, you know, how you built that culture and then, you know, how you've been able to maintain it.
Sure. So the biggest thing was that when we started, we were nobody. And so I had to kind of create an enemy to galvanize the troops, right? So I basically, at the time, Kansas City had the best tennis program in the area. And I said, okay, everybody, we're going to make these t-shirts with some sort of little slogan on there. And we're all going to wear them. And we're going to show up at this, you know, giant sectional tournament, 30 or 40 kids. And we're going to, you know, every time we play one of these kids from Kansas City, we're all going to go stand on the court and scream and yell and cheer. And, you know, I had to create an us versus them mentality to basically get the kids to rally together as a group, right? That was just the early goings of things. And I'd give speeches all the time at the club. And I'd say, look, guys, you know, the Kansas City guys are doing this and they're doing that and they're training way harder than we are. And I just create this sort of, you know, like, we're at battle with this group, right? And they'd say, okay, we got to work harder and harder. So, you know, the whole idea was to basically create an enemy in a way that we could, you know, kind of put up on, you know, like, you know, you make a joke, you would say, we're going to throw darts at, you know, at this one group, right? So we're going to put their picture up and we're going after these guys every tournament, and I just kept, you know, preaching this sort of, hey, those guys are out training you. Those guys are running sprints right now. They're not complaining, you know, this whole thing, right? And the whole idea became, we've got to be a team. We've got to work together. We've got to, you know, everybody's got to be a team to help each other get better. And when you create that, you'd be surprised. Teenagers love that stuff. And teenage tennis players oftentimes don't get the team experience that a lot of, let's say, baseball or football or basketball guys, you know, kids get. So it was actually, they gravitated to it. They loved it. And so, but that's how we started. And then from a coaching perspective, you know, everything was, you know, unit, you know, let's have our t-shirts, we're dialed in, let's get hats, let's create this culture. And we'd, you know, we'd have our little chants and we'd do like a football team, you know, we'd get in a circle of the tournaments and we'd break it down like, you know, 1, 2, 3, Tucker Tennis, you know, all this kind of stuff. Right. And when we were first getting going, you know, it maybe seemed a little odd, and then people started copying us, you know, and other groups started showing up at tournaments with t-shirts and doing little chants and cheers and all these things. But the whole idea was that I needed to do something to get everybody to rally behind the movement. And so we basically had to compete with somebody. So, and then once we got on top and we were doing really well, you know, the next thing was, how do you keep that going? Right. So then it was like, okay, we want to be the best in the nation. How do we, you know, we want to show up at national tournaments and people, when they play us, they're going to fear us because they know we're well-trained, we're conditioned, we're mentally tough, and we've got a bunch of people there supporting each other, right? And so you just create, I just worked really hard to kind of create this culture of getting kids to be a part of something a little bigger than themselves and get the parents to buy in and the kids to buy in. And then you fight for something, you run a little harder. You don't want to let your teammates down or the whole tradition down or the culture down. So, you know, that was a long time. It took probably a decade to really get that to come full circle, right? But, you know, once we got a little momentum going, and it kind of took care of itself. It fed on itself. But, you know, and it was, to be honest, it was super fun, super, super fun to build and to watch kids come together and support each other. And they're screaming for each other. Like, for me, those are some of the best memories, I think, of running the program, you know, with those years of kind of creating this team atmosphere. And I think we used to do a lot of speeches, myself and some of the coaches, and we'd try to give these kind of Rocky Balboa, you know, kind of like, you know, we'd play little music in the background and we'd give these speeches to the kids and try to get them all fired up and create this, you know, hey, we're in this together, we're taking over the world, you know, kind of thing. And you know, and kids love that stuff. So we've spent a lot of energy on basically giving the kids a reason to want to fight for something bigger than themselves.
And like I say, that's fantastic. And that's just what you don't see a lot in tennis, because it is an individual sport and everyone sort of has their own agenda. They have their own goals and it's different than the group. And, you know, like I say, Robert, you know, one of the things we saw in that documentary last night was just how, you know, the midnight workouts, you know, where everyone didn't want the next guy to see them quit or, you know, they kept pushing each other, you know, beyond. And we just don't see that much in tennis. And for you to create that sort of football team mentality at a tennis academy, you know, that's the magic. That's the thing that is missing. You know, you watch the coaches, they're yelling at players, but they're doing it because, you know, everyone wants to get better. But you don't really see that much at a tennis academy, where, you know, you don't see coaches getting in players' faces and other players getting in players' faces and going at it. And, you know, it just takes some of the passion out of the game when you don't have that team mentality or that team environment.
No doubt. Well, as I said, we used a lot of storytelling. You know, we talk about college matches where, you know, it'd be everybody's out there fighting for each other. And we'd talk a lot about, you know, in our clinics, how we could get the kids basically to police themselves, like you just mentioned. So we would basically assign groups, right? We'd say, okay, you five or over six over here, and you five or six over here, you guys make a team, you're gonna assign a captain, and, you know, losing teams, whatever, you're gonna run 20 win sprints or whatever, right? And we'll make them play. They can design their lineup and like mini college match, but we do it in 20, 30 minutes or something, right? But the whole idea was to just continue to entrench in these kids the mindset of, you know, it's bigger than you. You've got to run for every single ball because it, you know, it's going to affect all the people around you and this whole thing. And kids, they love that. I mean, no kid wants to be marooned out on an island, you know, just playing a match by themselves for 3 hours every day. It's just not that, you know, especially in today's world, it's very difficult to get a lot of kids to sign up for that. But they will come out and, you know, run for each other and fight for each other. And if you create the right culture where the kids police each other, like I had a kid I coached named Evan McElwain, and he ended up going to Cornell, and he won the Ivies as a freshman when they beat Harvard. I think he clinched the match. It was the first time Cornell ever won the Ivy championships. And Evan used to be such a champion for us when we needed him to kind of rally the troops. And I remember stories one time is that Evan pulled all the kids together one time at a drill clinic, and he screamed at all of them, like, what are you guys doing? You're wasting your time. You're wasting your opportunity. You know, why aren't you running for the balls and all this stuff? And like, you know, we were running sprints and kids were tanking the sprints, and he stopped everybody and screamed at them, why are you not trying? You know, all this kind of stuff. And that's when I recognized that we were winning, because it wasn't me and the coaches now screaming at the kids. It was their peers. And it was one of the best kids in the program, a leader. And when you get that, and then if you can repeat that year after year, I'd say he graduates and I get another guy. So what Matias and I used to do, and even before Matias, when I had this guy, Kevin Garlington, was a wonderful coach, we would pull kids into the office and say, okay, look, it's about to be your time to be the leader of this thing. And here's what we need you to do. Here's how, you know, you can do, you know, can help the program in all these different ways and kind of empower these kids. And some of them would run with it, and some of them wasn't really their thing, right? But if we could get three or four kids, you know, spread out over the program to be that extra voice, that you'd be amazed at how kids respond to peer pressure, right? From the better players in the program. You know, sometimes they get tired of hearing me scream and yell, but they might listen to another kid who's really, really good player, and it can you know, really make your job a lot easier. And also, it really deepens the, like, kind of the culture of fighting for stuff, you know, bigger than yourself and the whole program. And then we give these talks about, hey, you know, you might not want to try today because you're in a bad mood, but you're disrespecting 20 years of kids that have come before you. And I'd walk them out in the hallway and I'd show them, you know, the 250 college signs that we have, you know, plastered all over our wall. And I'd say, you see these 250 kids, if they saw your effort today, I'd be like, you know, they're going to be really upset, because they worked really hard and they care about this place and they care about you and the legacy you're leaving. They want to know that you're making this place and keeping this place special. So we would do a lot of that kind of culturing. And I think it paid big, big dividends, you know, in kind of, you know, repeating the model of success over many, many years.
Yeah, you know, when I coached football, the best team that we had a year that we went 13-1, and the best team that we worked with, you know, we used to always say we shouldn't have to coach effort, right? You may coach X's and O's, but you shouldn't have to coach effort. I think one of the interesting things about that team was the players started policing one another. And yep. You mentioned it, and they started pushing one another. Then you watched the documentary last night, and they're doing these midnight workouts because the Urban Meyer didn't want them going to the club, right? So he's like, well, we're going to do midnight workouts to prevent you from going to the club, right? So I thought one of the interesting things was, and they would do it from midnight to 2:30 in the morning, and they show Tim Tebow, and he says, man, it was, and you think he's going to say something like awful, hard, terrible, and he goes, it was awesome. And he said, it was one of the most exciting times of my life. And so part of this culture that you built is the players you bring into it, right? Because Tebow could have been a kind of guy that said, no, 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 I don't want to do that, and flipped everybody else's mentality. Instead, he's all in on it. Yeah. So did you ever have a player that was kind of like that for you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and we did. We had some that were born that way, and then we had a lot that we had to kind of nudge or help guide them. And you know, more of the second, really. But we had to bring a lot of kids in and say, look, you have such an opportunity to lead this group, you know, or such an opportunity to encourage kids to work hard or to come early or to be on time. So we've had kids over the years, lots of them, you know, whether it's, you know, back in the day, we had, you know, tons of, you know, great, you know, gold ball national championship winning kids that would, you know, basically lead the stretches in the morning and do the full warm up and make sure kids aren't slacking and they're on time. But, you know, it kind of goes to the next level, where what's in my mind, what's really important is when you have a kid who's, let's say, is 15, and he gets a 12-year-old up there to start, you know, kind of leading the stretches with him, right? And you start creating this sort of passing the baton mentality, whereas they sort of do it themselves, the kids. But for a long time, it was me and the coaches would pull somebody in the office and kind of try to anoint them in a way, like, you're going to be the one that's going to help us keep this thing going. These are young kids. You know, they're not, Tim Tebow was 20 at the time, probably, right? You know, these are 14, 15-year-old kids. But, you know, once the kids got, I think, bought into this whole thing, and then they would kind of basically anoint, like I said, the next one or the next couple kids or whatever. And that's when you know that the cycle is functioning right. You know, when you've got this sort of, they're almost like running their own little society in a way, right? And then we're sort of overseeing it as the coaches. But I think, you know, I was very, very fortunate to have some kids that did things the right way. You know, they weren't, like you said, they weren't in a position of power in the other kids' minds, and then they abused it and turned it negative. I was very fortunate that our kids that maybe were in a position of power wanted to be good. So they came on time. They were, you know, super disciplined, and they were pretty organized, and they would, you know, run for every ball, and they would, you know, this, I was very fortunate, because if I didn't have, like, you know, whether it's a Zeke Clark or a Nathan Hahn or some of these kids, you know, back in the day, you know, if I didn't have some of those kids around as our best players, it would have been very, very easy, you know, for someone to fill that void, that leadership role, who's not positive or not doing things the right way. And then it just becomes a constant struggle between the coaches and the kids, right? So I was lucky, I think, that I had some people like that, but also we worked really, really hard to empower those kids and to make them feel like it was their program too. And so that when you do that and you don't just run, you know, like a dictatorship on them, you'll oftentimes kids will, they'll step up. And I think at the end of the day, I had some good parents, you know, because you got to have parents that do a good job with their kids. So then the kids are receptive to these opportunities. You know, if the parents are teaching the kids to be entitled or spoiled brats, or, hey, you don't need the program, you just go off and do this by yourself kind of thing, you know, it kills the whole thing. I had a lot of parents that bought in and saw value in that. So that made our job a lot easier when we would approach somebody and say, hey, you know, we need a leader. you know, we want you to step up. And we're not like, we would, Matias and I would experiment. We would literally not even show up for an hour at practice sometimes. No one, no
coach. See what happens.
Yeah. And see what happens. And then we'd go hide in the windows upstairs in the cafe and the, like where the grill is. And we'd hide behind some chairs and we'd watch and see who's sitting down, who left, who's training, who's warming up correctly. And we'd take little notes. And then we'd come down and we'd have a meeting with all the kids for 20 or 30 minutes and try to dissect it all, right? You know, but then we'd also do stuff where Matias and I, the kids would lose focus and we'd be running practice together and we'd have, you know, 30 kids out there or whatever. And the kids would just be goofing around or they're screaming or rackets are flying off the curtains and kids are going nuts. And so Matias and I would just leave, wouldn't say anything and we'd just be gone. And we would, and then we would sneak back around the back of the building and open the door and get behind the curtains and watch and see what happens, right? And you could tell very quickly, you know, and then we'd pop back out and they'd all just snap back in shape or whatever. But you could tell very quickly where the leaders were and who wanted to really be good at tennis and who was there just passing time or whatever, right? So we did a lot of stuff like that.
Well, for me, you're not just teaching tennis, you're teaching leadership. Right. I mean, teaching young kids to be adults. Let me ask you one last question and we'll wrap up. This has been great, by the way. And Scott, if you got one after this, I'm wondering, you know, I don't think there's any crazier parent in sports than tennis parents. And it's a hard sport to be a parent in where, you know, if your player's playing softball or baseball, the parents can sit together and they win together, they lose together. Every other sport, the parents kind of almost become a family, where tennis, the parents almost are adversarial because their children are playing against each other. And then with coaches, they can be very demanding. So how would you say you dealt with parents, the good ones, let's say the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? The parents that were of all three, can you give some examples of how, as a coach, maybe you didn't push them away. You might have almost helped them to achieve the goal you were trying to achieve.
Yeah. I mean, you know, parent podcast should be a whole separate one. Maybe that's a very, for tennis, at least it's a very complicated dynamic, but you know, one of the things I think is that getting parents to understand that every child is on a different developmental cycle. Right, they're all going to develop in different time, because what happens?
Explain that real quick before you go. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's that every single kid has a different developmental schedule, right? Whether it's their puberty cycle, whether it's their learning curve, whether it's just you know, how, where they are in their entire playing, you know, life schedule, and maybe they only played 5 years versus a kid that's played 9 years, or maybe, you know, whatever it may be, every single child is unique in their process. But parents and children, especially both, fall prey to the dangers of comparisons. And when you get into a world of comparisons in tennis, it will eat you alive. And, you know, I have so many stories of mom and dad comes in. Well, you know, little Johnny was beating, you know, Tommy at, you know, 6 months ago, and now he's losing. So we got to change everything. We need to change the coach. We need to change the program. We need to change the rack. I mean, it was like crazy, right? And I'd say, you know, look, everything that's happening for your child is what you need to focus on, right? And not compare them to somebody else's developmental, you know, kind of progress or cycle. And it's very difficult because people are competitive. Parents are competitive. Kids are competitive. And that's why it's so important to have that communication, those quarterly meetings with the coach and the parents and the kid and everybody in the room, have discussions about where we're going, what's the effort level like, how are they working on the three or four areas of focus, you know, stuff like that, right? And so, you know, I saw a lot of parents get lost or caught up in the comparisons. They got lost or caught up in the short-term results. And you know, I guess me being someone who developed so late in the process and continued to develop it late into his 20s, I was very patient in the way that I, you know, would coach people, right? But parents, you know, when they're spending whatever X amount of dollars and there's a lot of pressure and kid comes home and says, I don't want to play anymore, I keep losing to so-and-so, right? You know, and when you hear those things maybe come out of your child's mouth, you feel more pressure to, you know, so people panic a little bit. My you know, my hope was that I could sit down with parents and have a very calm and educated conversation about their child's kind of style as a learner, their style as an athlete, and also maybe how hard their kid works, like a blunt, honest conversation about how your kid works, because every single parent gets the same mouthful from their kid when they come home. How was practice today? Great. Did you work hard? Yes. You know, did you beat so-and-so? Mom and dad always ask if they beat their, you know, whoever's close in their UTR range, right? That's the classic get in the car ride, you know, interrogation. You know, did you play with so-and-so? Who'd you play with? Did you play with someone better than you? Did you beat them? And so then what happens is the parents come to these meetings armed with a lot of bad information. Okay. So it's up to the coaches to make sure that they're sitting down. And so Matthias and I, just out of an abundance of suffering, we started to track every single result of everything in every practice and write it down. So mom and dad would call up and say, well, so-and-so hasn't played with anybody good in 3 weeks. We want him out of this class. And I'd say, well, I don't know if you're exactly right. Here's every single game that they played. Here's every set, every match, every practice game, every court they've been on. We documented everything. And we give them this book of data, and the parents' jaws would hit the floor and go, oh my God, I'm only getting 5% of the story. So then, you know, and you know, some parents would want to come to practice and sit and watch or whatever from a window or a distance or whatever, you know, which is because they wanted to kind of basically confirm or deny all of our data, right? And Matthias and I would just have to say to them politely, look, you know, give your kid the space to feel like practice is theirs, like they own it, and they can be free to be goofy occasionally. They can be free to experiment. They can have some fun. Because if you're watching them play an up and down the courts and they lose to a kid that has a UTR a point lower than them because they're working on something, or that other kid just played great, who cares? It doesn't matter. Don't get lost in that stuff. But man, we have battled some crazy, crazy stuff where people would come to us. I had a parent come to me once and they wrote down how many balls their kid hit per hour. They were tracking the number of balls hit. And I said, well, okay, if for you, it's simply a volume game. That's all you care about is volume. You don't care about any, because maybe I gave a 20-minute speech one day about competing and about being your best self. And all, you know, maybe I'd give a long speech and we'd lose, 30% of practice that day. But I felt like it was important because if I got that point across, the next 10 practices were going to be really powerful, right? And this mom or dad would come to me with, you know, well, we're not hitting enough balls and they're not doing this and all this stuff. Which, by the way, my ultimate pet peeve, and I hope this gets out to every tennis parent in the world, is don't say we. You are not we. Your kid is training. Your kid is competing. It makes my skin crawl when I see a mom or a dad and I say, how did, you know, Tony do in the tournament? And they said, we did great. What do you mean we did great? It drives me nuts, but that's a separate topic. But you know, your kid competed well and you drove them there and dropped them off. Thank you. You know, but anyways, you know, it's a tough thing to be a tennis parent, no doubt. But if the communication with the coach is regular and honest, and like I've had to tell parents, your kid doesn't run for every ball. And they'd say, they would just be flabbergasted, right? And I'd say, that's just the truth. Your kid has selective effort. And with selective effort is going to come mixed results, right? You're going to get all, I mean, but if you're a kid that's fighting for every single ball, every moment that you're out there, you're over time, you're going to leave another batch of kids behind. You're going to get a lot better, right? But parents would just, you know, they couldn't believe me when I would tell them stuff like that. Or I would explain to parents, look, you know, your kid, you know, when they compete, they freak out and throw their racket every 5 points and I can't, you know, coach them effectively, right? They'd say, oh, no, what are you talking about? You know, I think the best thing, you know, here is really when you're dealing with a tennis parent that is aggressive or, you know, maybe doesn't, you know, want to hear that type of stuff, is to have video for them, right, that they can access. But then also to write reports that are both good and bad. You know, you do both, right, and submit those reports to the parent and then have a meeting more regularly with parent, player, and coach and say, these are the things that we're seeing on a regular basis. And that way it's now you know, everybody's working together. It's not the parent complaining to the coach all the time. You know, the best tennis parents we had were really our partners in the journey. And we could be super, super direct with them and just say, look, your kid gave a bad effort today. You know, they need to bring it tomorrow. You know, if you have an opportunity to be a parent tonight and just say, you know, and educate your kid on the value of effort and an organization and punctuality and hard work and respect and those things, that's going to go a long way in allowing us to coach them hard and coach them well. So, yeah. You know,
I know Scott's going to follow up with a question. I'm wondering this though, when, like you mentioned, a kid that doesn't give good effort, a kid that throws a racket, a kid that whatever, when you as the coach told the parent that, what did you want the parent to do about it? Because you know how it is. I mean, if your own child throws the racket in practice or in a match, there's really not a lot you can do about it. Nope. At a USTA event. So what did you expect from the parent when you told them that?
What we want or what we expect is for them to support us as coaches when we take the appropriate action.
Got it.
That's the ticket. What I need as a coach is I need to know that the parents have my back when I sit your kid down for 45 minutes and make them take notes on matches because they threw their racket, or because your kid threw their racket off a curtain, you know, whatever, one time. You know, I'm gonna sit them down and you know, make them whatever, make them go run, you know, 20 sprints, whatever it is, doesn't matter. The whole idea is that we need to know that you guys, the parents, are in full trust of us to do the right thing by your kid from a discipline perspective. And if we don't discipline them out of fear of you not supporting it, then we've done the child a huge disservice, right? I mean, and oftentimes my disciplinary approach was very much conversational as opposed to maybe physical punishment. You know, I mean, right. I would try to pull the whole group in. If like, let's say I've got four girls, you know, over here playing, and they're being little angels, and I got four boys over here just going nuts. They're cussing, throwing rackets. I'm being a little stereotypical, but that kind of, sometimes that's how it is, right? And so I would call all eight of them in, and I would say, look, guys, the deal is this. If we as a group don't stop throwing our rackets and saying bad words, we're all going to run. And the girls would look at me like, what are you doing? You know, we didn't do anything wrong. We're just playing hard, you know. But again, that's part of the team culture. It's part of building this academy sort of, you know, we're all in this together kind of thing. And, you know, I trust me, when the boys get to a certain age, they don't want to make the girls mad at them. And so, you know, it's just, you know, what I didn't want is every single practice that I had to do something like that, I get a phone call from one of the girls' moms that says, you took away 15 minutes of my daughter's practice today because you disciplined the group for stuff she wasn't involved in. That's annoying. I mean, what I need to know, because at the end of the day, those girls are going to go to college and they're going to have a team of 10 girls. And one of those girls is going to throw their racket one day and they're all going to run. And if that's foreign to her, by the time she gets there, I failed them.
That's a good lesson. And, you know, like you say, going back to the whole, you know, academy team thing, you know, it's not an individual practice. It's a group and a part of the team. And when the overall group needs to be disciplined, that's how it goes. So, yeah. So, hey, Trent, I know that you've got some things coming up. We got to get going, but we definitely need to do a part three. We didn't get to everything we wanted to get to. And I got a few questions from some of your former employees that I want to throw in as well. So I'll come
with that in the next one. Oh boy, that sounds a little scary, but I'm excited to talk to you guys again.
Yeah, if you're all down, right. We're down. Yeah.
All right, wonderful guys. Thanks so much.
Hey, all right, Trent. Good luck on the pickleball match.
I know I'm gonna need it. I'm playing some ringers today. Thanks.
All right, see ya.
All right, see you guys. Bye.